So what's your story? They're up next. Have a great week, and we'll see you next week. KPFT, Houston.
The Unruffled Beat of Ray Lynch's Clouds Below Your Knees signals 8 p.m. Thursday and times for So What's Your Story? The only program originating in Houston devoted entirely to storytelling, and it's right here on listener-sponsored KPFT 90.1 FM in Houston. I'm your host tonight, Mary Edgerton, and I work with So What's Your Story with an ensemble of gifted hosts. Dr. Hank Rubicek is our show's founder and producer. Greg Audell, who always appears with Floyd the Wonder Dog as an added benefit. And Dr. Warren Holloman, our master of wellness. These guys are not only gifted hosts, they're also great storytellers. Rounding out our team, we have our stellar intern, also our acting chief engineer and media maven, Justin O'Neill. Together with our guest storytellers that we bring on the show every week, we celebrate the power of story. Stories are something special. The listener doesn't just embark upon a journey that's orchestrated by the teller. It's more as though the listener enters the world of the storyteller and feels the story through the storyteller's visual and emotional lens. Tonight, you will experience a number of these special journeys from our storytellers Hank Rubicek, Zachary Kaufman, and Alfonso Lopez de la Osa Escribano as our storytellers. I have chosen a special destination for our stories for this broadcast. Monday, January 27th, is International Holocaust Remembrance Day. I know that our listeners know Hank Rubicek as our producer, a host of the show, and as a storyteller. But did you know that Hank's grandparents and mother were in concentration camps in Germany during World War II? Did you know that he's a seasoned docent at the Houston Holocaust Museum here in Houston? For these reasons, I have asked Hank to start off by explaining what International Holocaust Remembrance Day means to a survivor's son, so that we may not just engage you, our faithful listeners, at our offness, but bring you in a special way to hear and experience these stories and feel the remembrance through them. So, Hank, You want to tell us a little bit about what International Remembrance Day is?
Thank you, Mary. I really do appreciate the opportunity. And yet I'm afraid that a lot of our listeners do know that I'm a docent at the Holocaust Museum. I tell so many stories on the air that at least makes reference to that. So I really do appreciate the opportunity. But, you know, if I could take just a few seconds, Mary, and talk about something else we need to remember, and that is that we are kicking off our fund drive, which, boy, I'll tell you, there seems to be one at every turn, and because there is. But we want to remind everyone that we are listener-sponsored, and the great, great programming that we offer here on KPFT in our very eclectic program inventory, including So What's Your Story, is predicated exclusively on them helping us out. So 713-526-5738 would be greatly appreciated. We've got some of our steadfast volunteers out there to take your call, and we're going to be kicking it more into high gear next week. You know, it's funny that you say that my mother and my grandparents in Germany, they moved to Germany because they thought it was safe. They were really from Lithuania. Most Jews lived in Eastern Europe, but was not Western Europe. You know, it's always interesting how some people think that the majority of Jews lived in Germany or France, the Netherlands, but in fact, most of the Jews lived in Poland and the Ukraine and places like that. And there were many pogroms, many small little violent riots. And they moved to Berlin because they thought it was safe. After all, it was a liberal city, a place where intellectuals ruled, where we had arts and music. A lot of anecdotes for narrow-mindedness and prejudice. Wasn't to be the case. When I was 9 years old, I remember watching my grandmother entrenched in a story that interrupted the Ed Sullivan Show in 1961. Now, for those of you who are really ancient like me, you know what I'm talking about. If not, Ed Sullivan was a show that was on every Sunday night. Eastern time, it was at 8 o'clock. And we had one TV, black and white, 19-inch. My grandmother ruled the television. You couldn't watch anything unless she told us you could. We had one remote, me. I had to get up and change the channel if we wanted it. And I was watching her at the age of 9 years old, watching her watch this show. And she was mesmerized by something. I asked her what it was. And she told me that it was about Adolf Eichmann, who was sentenced to death in Israel for war crimes. This is 1961. Now, it was the only death sentence ever carried out in Israel, and one that followed in the shadows of the Nuremberg trials, where other criminals were executed or severely punished. Now, I asked my survivor, Grammy, about this guy. I'm 9 years old, remember. And she told me in a simple way about the Holocaust. Now, my first response was, well, I don't know what you're talking about, but it's something that had to have happened a gazillion years ago. In my youthful arrogance, it's the same message I get from students that I take on tours at the Holocaust Museum Houston, where I've served as a docent since 1998, 2 years after it opened. This is old stuff, students tell me. It's a museum. It's not old, I tell them. My mother, a survivor of Stutthof concentration camp, along with my grandmother, were together, and my mother is still alive and well living in Florida. It's still very new to her. When I was 40, my mom told me that she was being interviewed by one of Steven Spielberg's folks to interview survivors for his Shoah documentary. And she asked me what I thought, and my first impression was, great, but you're not much of a public speaker, Mom, and I'm 40 years old, of course, and I thought I knew all the stories. But what a bad answer that was. It was astonishing. When I watched her 45-minute-long video, I changed forever. My life literally changed forever. She spoke about watching her brother killed. I also learned how storytelling really transformed us. I remember she pointed to a weed, a little daffodil, a little dandelion, excuse me, that was crushed, and it was in a small frame on her mantelpiece. And the interviewer asked her what that was, and she talked about this being something that my grandfather gave my grandmother before he was deported to Dachau. And I really learned not only how storytelling transformed us, but what love was. Well, January 27th is International Holocaust Remembrance Day. It was designated by the United Nations General Assembly resolution on November 1st, 2005, to commemorate the tragedy of the Holocaust as we remember and we honor the deaths of 11.5 million people, 6 million of them were Jews, 1.5 million being children under the age of 14. That's 30 Astrodomes lined up next to each other with 30 children in each. That's 1.5 million. You know, instinct told my mother, my grandmother, excuse me, that 14 years old was for some reason an important age. So when she and my mother registered at Stutthof to provide proof of age, my grandmother pinched her so she'd yell, at which time she told the Gestapo, "Oh, sorry, she stepped on a stone, but she's 14 years old." My mother was 13. All the children under 14 were separated from their mothers and killed immediately. My grandmother saved her life. She saved several when she, my mother, and a few other women darted from the death march as the Red Army was entering Nazi-occupied soil, hid in a barn, and heard all the other women murdered by machine guns. And then less than 15 minutes later, she heard voices of Russian soldiers. And knowing Russian, my grandmother left the barn, told them they were here, and all the women hovering inside were liberated. What strikes me now is really pretty simple. Hate hasn't gone away. It rears its vicious head every day. The museum poses hard questions about integrity and justice and about love and compassion and the differences among people serving as blessings, not constraints. It also speaks to human rights. Those that are righteous go far beyond Raoul Wallenberg and Meep in the Diary of Anne Frank. There are countries like Denmark who said, "We're going to save our Jews because they're Danes, they're people, and we're going to stand firm." And they did. I'm not sure what we do. I'm not sure that Americans would do anything different from those in Berlin and anywhere in Nazi-occupied Europe, because most didn't do anything at all, save just a few. Many said, "I didn't know this was happening." They did, but they were passive. And to be passive and compliant is to be the perpetrator. It's to commit heinous crimes. Nazism wasn't just political. It was a philosophy that transformed society. Art, education, music, religion, and propaganda fueled distorted beliefs and the lessons behind the Holocaust, as my relatives and any survivor would tell you with great conviction, have not yet been learned. We still hate. The UN still refuses to acknowledge what we did to Native Americans as genocide. Many of us still don't get it. So we reflect during this very special day, Holocaust Remembrance Day, a day that will hopefully and eventually bring peace.
Hank, that's a tough act to follow.
Just something I threw together.
You know, as you started, and I have to tell everybody, I didn't see what Hank was going to say before this. And he mentioned that his mother was closely listening to the radio. And I thought, oh, I need to mention that my mother tells me that her grandmother was closely listening to the radio during the Nuremberg trials. But our family was safe in Texas in a completely different environment. And thankfully, yes, for them, but it's a hard act to follow, Hank.
Well, thank you. Obviously, that wasn't the goal, and I was being joking when I said just something I threw together. You know, things like this come so naturally to me. I'm not sure that's good, but they really do come very naturally to me. You know that a lot of my stories, and you were at the Moth this last time in December when I told the story about my grandfather, a lot of my stories really do come from my grandparents because I spent so much time with them. I had the good fortune. I didn't know it at the time. I don't think I would have labeled it as good fortune. But, you know, three generations lived together in one house, and I was with my grandparents all the time. Lots of my friends were. And it was a whole different world, literally. I was taught not to trust. That's not good. You know, when you're a kid and you're told no one likes you, be careful. Date certain people, go certain places, make certain friends. You kind of nod your head and say, yeah, okay, like whatever. But you understand that they really meant it. They didn't mean to mean it, right? but it's just something that you learn growing up, and I'm not really happy about that. I remember my grandmother always having a bag of crackers in her purse, literally driving two blocks to my aunt. She had to have crackers in her purse so that there wouldn't be a moment when she would go hungry.
It is a terrible time and one never to be forgotten, which is why we are remembering this
yes.
coming International Holocaust Remembrance
Day.
And
I do appreciate the opportunity. And a little bit later on, after we hear from your wonderful guest storytellers, I do have a quick story from one of our Houston survivors that I think listeners will really enjoy.
So I mentioned the names of my storytellers tonight, but I want to tell you a little bit more about each of them as we hear their stories. Alfonso López de la Osa Escribano is the director of the Center for U.S. and Mexican Law at the University of Houston. He has been very involved with international law, specifically how legal systems interact across countries, and he has a particular interest in health law. I actually met him through his activities as a patient, or I might say a citizen advocate, on committees at MD Anderson Cancer Center, where I work. So, Alfonso, I know that you have a very special story to tell us about a close connection that you have to the Holocaust. Can you share that with us?
Thank you very much, Mary, for inviting me to be tonight here with you all. Of course, yes, I'm delighted to share this story with you. I would like actually to share the story of a Spanish ambassador whose name was Ángel Sanz Briz. He was ambassador mostly under General Franco's dictatorship, and he was known afterwards to be known as the Angel of Budapest. Why the Angel of Budapest? Because he saved thousands of Hungarian Jews' lives between World War II, Jews that were going to be deported to the horror of Auschwitz by Hitler. I know this story mainly by my family. In fact, I'm lucky enough to be somehow a bit distantly related to this incredible man, and also to be a friend of a few of his grandson and granddaughters. My mother and aunt were very good friends of Ángel Sanz Briz's daughters, Adela and Paloma, and actually the wife of my great aunt, so the brother of my grandmother, was married to a direct cousin, a first cousin of Ángel Sanz Briz's wife. So I knew the story by my grandmother, that when we were young, she would share with us constantly in our winter's days, in around the tea or with soda, about this incredible story. And she was actually my abuela Carmina, was a great and very eloquent storyteller. Ángel Sanz Briz was born in 1910 in Zaragoza in Spain and died in 1980 in Rome. He was a very bright and educated person. He came from a wealthy Spanish family of industrial entrepreneurs. He became a lawyer first at the Central University of Madrid, that it actually became the University Complutense of Madrid, where is where I did my JD, and what after my PhD I was a professor for 10 years. So important university there. In 1933 and until 1936, he joins the diplomatic schools. He meets Franco, because he had a close relationship with Franco during Spanish Civil War, when he became the truck driver for the Moroccan army Franco created in 1937 to prepare the attack to the Spanish Second Republic. Although Ángel Sanz Briz was a very discreet person about his enormous accomplishment, we always grew up in my family knowing about what such good actions he had taken to save thousands of Jews from the horrific hands of Hitler and his henchmen. In the middle of World War II, in 1942, Ángel Sanz Briz is sent to Budapest to the Spanish embassy, becoming first secretary of the Spanish legation. Between 1942 and December 1944, he was in this embassy. Hitler invaded Hungary in March 1944, and Colonel Eichmann started sending Jews to concentration camps. He started the deportation of these Hungarian Jews to Auschwitz, among others, and the world, we have to say, was already aware, clearly aware in 1944, about the atrocities Hitler had been doing even before that date. So Ángel Sanz Briz, Ambassador Sanz Briz, knew that this was wrong, very wrong, and he decided to use his position to set a plan to save thousands of Jews with the assistance of the members of the Spanish embassy. He had a very brilliant legal idea to avoid the diplomatic conflict between Spain and Nazi Hungary. He had to do it very discreetly, because if the Arrow Cross Party, the Hungarian Nazi government, would have known what he was doing, he would have been for sure stopped and they would have interfered in the operation. So during June 1944 and December the same year, Ángel Sanbrís issued 5,200 passports and safe conducts to Jews that were in Budapest, naturalizing them as Spanish. With this, they could travel freely to Spain and become citizens. Ambassador Sanbrís argued the existence of legal disposition to do that. But to understand the argument, we need to do a little parenthesis and understand why this right to become Spanish, or where does it come from? In 1942, the Jews that didn't want to convert into Catholicism had to leave Spain. They were expelled. These Spanish Jews were called Sephardim, Sephardis, and were known to have always kept their love for the country and even the language, with a type of dialect very close to very old Spanish Castilian. In fact, Sephardim are descendants of Jews who lived in the Iberian Peninsula from the 10,000 years, so since the second millennium. In 1924, Primo de Rivera dictatorship in Spain under the reign of King Alfonso XIII decreed that every Sephardic descendant could claim the Spanish nationality. Unfortunately, this disposition was repealed in 1930, but with a very smart strategy, Ambassador Sanbrís convinced the Nazi Hungarian authorities that this law, this decree, still into force, so the Jewish could claim Spanish nationality. If this decree was for Sephardic Jews, Ambassador Sanbrís actually issued most of the passport and safe conducts for Ashkenazi Jews, meaning Jews from, as you know, Germanic and Slavic descent, and very few Sephardic Jews. If this may have been noticed in certain cases by the person's last names, the governments in Spain have been issuing traditionally the list of Sephardic last names in order to help the procedure of claiming the nationality. And to avoid any risk Ambassador Sanbrís and the personnel from the embassy had, they even taught Spanish to the Jews that were in Hungary. They went to the ghettos, they took them, and they brought them to places where personnel from the embassy would teach them few words of Spanish in order that if the authorities would ask them, but what is the tradition you have, they would at least be able to say some words. Even if Spain was considered a friendly country to the Nazis, to Germany, Ambassador Sanbrís showed to have nerves of steel while doing this in such a tense situation. He started doing the visas in a person-by-person way, but ended up including a whole family, so he was helping as much persons as he could. As the Nazis under Eichmann were activating the deportation, administrative procedures were getting slower and slower. So he even went further. To hide the Jews, he used the Spanish embassy. He rented apartments where he put the Jews that were expecting to get the visa, and sometimes with his own expenses. He even put in these apartments Spanish flags so that they became Spanish territory and Nazis won't inspect those places. He also had hidden Jews in his own private residence. If the living conditions in those apartments that he created weren't optimal during those weeks, the Jews were knowing that they were the gate to freedom and life. Also, the Spanish embassy could openly go to the ghettos, and they, because they were openly in good terms with Germany, and take over 500 Jews to nationalize them. Ambassador Sanbrís knew that he could do visas until 200 without any issue. If he would ask for more than 200 visas, it would become complicated. So he had, again, a very interesting idea. The Nazis were going to see the numeration of the visas according to what the embassy would have done. So instead of issuing visa number 1, visa number 2, visa number 3, he would do visa number 1 and adding a letter sequence. So visa number 1A was a person, visa number 1B was a second person, and so and so. But the visa number 1 still was a single visa for the whole family. He could get more than So he would stop at 200 and then start again with a different letter, what allowed him to save 5,200 people. Ambassador Sainte-Brie duly informed Franco's Secretary of Foreign Affairs, José Félix de Lequerica, about this action. We have an official correspondence about it, with a very interesting way of saying it, Ambassador, the Secretary of Foreign Affairs, Lequerica. He was urging Sainte-Brie to keep on doing whatever he could, as long as it was legal. But, of course, he was claiming a legislation that wasn't anymore in force, and to save as many lives as he could. As the Soviet Red Army was approaching Budapest in 1944, Franco ordered Ambassador Sainte-Brie to flee to Austria by historic reasons that are completely understandable. Franco's personnel were a specific target of the Soviet Union and the Soviet Red Army. So each time the invasion happened, they were fleeing to be protected. But what happened here is even more a proof of the intelligence of that man. He named, de facto, unofficially, an Italian businessman that was named Giorgio Perlasca as the consul from Spain in Budapest, so that he could keep on doing what he was doing before. Giorgio Perlasca had to deal with the proper administration, Hungarian administration, because they were starting to get nervous, and Curie said, you cannot issue those visas, we are waiting for Ambassador Sainte-Brie. I said, no, I'm trying to keep on working while he is coming back. Ambassador Sainte-Brie never came back. But in the meantime, he could save Giorgio Perlasca 5,000 more people. For his action, the Holocaust Museum Yad Vashem of the State of Israel gave his family the title of Righteous Among the Nations. Also, in 1944, the government of Hungary gave him the Cross of the Order of Merit of the Republic of Hungary. In Budapest, Ángel Sainte-Brie has an avenue, a street named after him, since 2015. He became, after that, a very well-known diplomat, and dying in Rome in 1980 as an ambassador to the Holy See. So, pretty interesting person.
Very interesting. And I think you told me before that he was always very humble about these accomplishments.
Extremely humble. I believe these type of persons belong to other generations in which what you were doing on one side wasn't even known by the others, but your other relatives or families. He really lived it very humbly as a duty that he had to do without the need of telling everyone what this was happening.
It is very positive to think that there are people, and hopefully continue to be people, who feel as though simply practicing what is right is normal, not over and above. That's a magnificent mm-hmm. story, and I appreciate your relationship to him. Just quickly, we only have a few more minutes. There was another leader who protected a Jewish community in Germany. In his country, not in Germany, albeit with a compromise of supporting Nazi Germany with needed food supplies. Christian X of Denmark. Different story here. Mm-hmm. Not a personal connection. Do you know that a little bit about that story?
Yes, a very interesting story about Christian X of Denmark. That was one of those kings that had to live two world wars. So he's
two world wars. So he was alive in World War mm-hmm. One. Yeah,
he became king at 41 years old in 1912 and died in 1947.
Wow!
So indeed, he was. There was a sort of a legend that said that he wore Yellow Star to prove his support to the Jewish community. This hasn't been completely able to confirm it, but what we know for sure is that the first part of the German domination of Denmark that was more peaceful until 1943, and then it became more belligerent when the Nazis took over militarily the country, and then started through the German authorities coming there to deport Jewish to Bohemia, so to what is currently the Czech Republic. And at that moment, very actively, the king, Christian of Denmark, took over and openly manifested his support to avoid the deportation of the Jewish.
So that's a very interesting story, and I would urge all our listeners to visit the Houston Holocaust Museum. Interestingly, the over 7,000 Jews were rescued from Norway in a very short period, not Norway, Denmark, in a very short period of time, and boatlifted to Sweden by both Danish and Swedish fishermen. And the Houston Museum actually celebrates that. And in fact, the U.S. Holocaust Museum in Washington had an exhibit about how the Danes saved over 7,000 Jews. And it was actually a borrowed exhibit from the Houston Museum. It's a very fascinating story. I really urge you to visit the museum and read that. I know peripherally about this story because of my background in physics with Niels Bohr, who hypothesized the theory of quantum mechanics and was a Danish Jew whose family was saved by the boat lift. And I'm going to stop here. We're at the middle of the hour and go to station identification with Justin. Justin.
Hello.
Hey.
Hi.
So what's happening in the city of storytelling?
First, I want to say something about our show. If you don't have a radio, it's no excuse for missing it because you can listen to us live on kpft.org or on Facebook Live on So What's Your Story Facebook page. But yes, there are some important storytelling venues in town. Let's start with the Houston Storytellers Guild. Join them because this is the best group to work with to start cultivating your storytelling talent. Just get to their monthly story swaps held on the fourth Tuesday of every month from 7 to 8:30 p.m. at Temple Emmanuel at 1500 Sunset. Go to their website, www.houstonstorytellers.org, for upcoming events and all of our past So What's Your Story programs, every radio show since 2008, listed under radio program.
Hey, and are we anywhere else on the net?
We are. We also post on YouTube, so check out our program clips there and tell us what you think about our shows or suggest program ideas by visiting So What's Your Story Facebook page, and we promise to get back to you. Please be sure to share our page with friends, and yes, we'd love it if you like us when you leave. Don't forget our friends at the Moth at Warehouse Live the second Tuesday of the month. And this is coming up on Tuesday, February 11th. The theme is going to be Love Hurts, and yes, it does, so get your story ready.
Okay, and I'm just going to add a little plug that I'm going to be hosting So What's Your Story on February 13th with some fascinating love stories. Justin, any other events in February we need to consider?
There is. There is a Wimberley Storytelling Festival, February 22nd, and rather than me describe it, let me play a little jingle from it.
June 22, 2020, the Storytelling Festival in beautiful Wimberley. Everyone has a story to tell. It's a tradition as old as time. Wimberley's first storytelling fest invites you to come, listen, laugh, and learn. Look at us. We're bringing storytellers in from all over Texas. Houston, Austin, San Antonio, and the Hill Country, too. Famous tellers, award-winning PBSers, indigenous elders, and local jawboners. We'll see you at 7A Ranch Opera House on 2/22/2020. The Storytelling Festival in beautiful Wimberley.
So if anybody remembers the Beverly Hillbillies, ha-ha, Wimberley has taken over. Okay, Justin, and what is happening next Thursday at 8 p.m. here on KPFT?
Well, we have a wonderful and very touching hour with Dr. Warren Holloman next Thursday. He will be hosting Jackie Ford and Kent Keith with stories about family that will touch on grief and loss.
Grief and loss. Yes, thank you, Justin. I know that I'll be listening. And loss is an ever-present event in our lives, yet each one is unique in how it affects us. I know that tonight we're talking about overwhelming loss and overwhelming grief. But I am hoping that some of our stories of rescuers will help to inspire us to realize that even in small ways, we can do something. In our last story, I mentioned that the famous Nobel Prize-winning physicist Niels Bohr was saved by the Swedish and Danish boat lift of Jews to Sweden. But there's another famous physicist who also had to escape Europe at this time, Albert Einstein. Now, that's a name that we all know. He sent several letters to President Roosevelt concerning his concerns over the German efforts to develop a nuclear bomb, and those are quite well known. I knew of those. I studied physics. I know a lot about Albert Einstein. But to tell you the truth, I never knew the details of how he escaped Germany. So now I'd like to introduce our storyteller, Zachary Kaufman. Zach is also a member of the faculty at the University of Houston Law School. His area of specialization is international law and human rights, including genocide studies. I know him as we are both Marshall scholars and had the opportunity to study in the United Kingdom. So, Zach, I knew that Albert Einstein had been in Germany and then he was in the U.S., but there are details of the in-between. Can you tell us about that?
Well, thank you, Mary. It's wonderful to be on the show tonight to commemorate the upcoming International Holocaust Remembrance Day. And the story of Albert Einstein's survival, like the other stories we've been telling tonight, is really a larger story about the rescue of Jews by non-Jews, including Muslims, during the Holocaust. Yad Vashem, the Holocaust Memorial and Research Center in Israel that we've already been talking about, has documented over 27,000 what they call, as my colleague Alfonso mentioned, righteous among the nation, and among the nations. And these are non-Jews who risked their lives to save Jews during that genocide. Although some Muslims, such as the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem, Hajj Amin al-Husseini, conspired with Nazis during the Holocaust, other Muslims in Albania, Bosnia, Germany, the former Soviet Union, and Turkey, in fact, saved Jews. Yad Vashem has officially recognized more than 70 Muslims as righteous among the nations. For example, in Albania, Europe's only Muslim-majority country at the time, almost all of the approximately 200 indigenous Jews and 1,800 Jewish refugees survived. In fact, Albania was reportedly the only country in Europe to emerge from World War II with a larger Jewish population than before. This all started when Albanian King Zog I invited Jews to Albania in the 1930s to help develop the country. When the Nazi regime's reach began threatening even those in Albania, an Albanian code of honor, Besa, compelled all residents to safeguard those in need. This code was based on Islamic tenets, characterizing as blessed conduct the saving of a life. The son of an Albanian man, recognized by Yad Vashem as righteous among the nations, explained that his father, Nuro Haksa, sheltered four Jewish families because, quote, as devout Muslims, we extended our protection and humanism to the Jews. Why? Besa, friendship, and the Holy Quran, end quote. Even Albert Einstein benefited from Albanian assistance in his emigration from Europe to the United States. In 1935, he stayed on the Albanian coast for 3 days in the Royal Mansion. Given an Albanian passport, Einstein then traveled through Europe to eventually the United States. There are so many lessons to be drawn from the example set by Albanians during the Holocaust. One lesson is about choice. In times of crisis, we all have a choice. Earlier this week, we celebrated Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Memorial Day. Dr. King said, quote, man's inhumanity to man is not only perpetrated by the vitriolic actions of those who are bad, it's also perpetrated by the vitiating inaction of those who are good, end quote. We often can choose to be bystanders or upstanders. One person can make a difference. And these situations aren't usually as extreme as saving someone during genocide or undertaking such immense risk that it threatens our lives. Take the Me Too movement, for example. We now know that lots of people knew about the sexual abuse perpetrated by Harvey Weinstein, Larry Nassar, and others, and chose to do nothing, not even report it to the authorities. Bystanderism enables crime. Where possible, we all, each and every one of us, should instead be upstanders. A second lesson is about Islam. A prevailing narrative about Islam recently in the United States and abroad is that it's a religion of violence. Extremist Muslims have inarguably been responsible for perpetrating many horrific mass killings over the past two decades. And terrorists have exploited certain Quranic verses to try to justify their heinous crimes. Since the 9/11 attacks, Islamophobia has skyrocketed in the United States and around the world. More recent assaults in the United States and elsewhere have helped reinforce such stereotypes. And the resulting racism and xenophobia have bled into politics and policy. One need only consider President Trump's proposal to ban all Muslims, at least temporarily, from immigrating to the United States. But as in the case of Albania, history demonstrates that Islamic teaching and practice offer their adherents laudable resources to encourage extraordinary selflessness, empathy, and courage. When odious crimes against humanity have taken place, Muslims have often drawn on their faith to rescue people of other religions, including Christians and Jews. As I mentioned, Muslim men and women in Albania sought to protect others at great risk to themselves, their families, and their communities, not in spite of, but often inspired by, their faith. The significant yet underappreciated and seldom celebrated role of Muslims as rescuers during conflicts, including genocide and other mass atrocities, should remind us that Muslims, like other religious groups, are not homogenous. Similarly, the Quran, like other religious texts, can be interpreted in multiple ways, sometimes for ill, but often also for good. Thank you, Mary.
You know, just going back to Albert Einstein going through Albania, and everything you said about the misunderstanding of religions and the use of religious dogma to carry out the incorrect application of religious dogma to carry out crimes. These are terrible things. I just want to mention, Albania was such a mystery to me as I was growing up. I read these mystery novels, and I remember there was one where someone, through some action, was accidentally shipwrecked on the shores of Albania and had no way of escape. You know, this was a very mysterious nation to us. Then this was before widespread internet and so on. So this, imagine North Korea shrouded in more secrecy than it is today because of the lack of information about it. That was Albanian. And so it was often used in novels. I remember it being used in a spy movie, The Ipcress File. And they were saying to someone, "You are in Albania," which was as though saying, you know, you're in the alternate universe. And to find out that it was so active in this period in helping Jews to escape is a really a novel piece of education for me. And I think, as you said, something remarkable to say about true Islam. Now, let me ask you, you know, we've been talking about heroes and heroes in Europe during this horrible time of the Holocaust. Is there a hero that stands out to you?
You know, there are really so many examples of inspiring courage during the Holocaust, Mary. Some upstanders are more successful than others in achieving their objectives in providing assistance, and context, of course, matters a lot. And because upstanders can't know whether the assistance they provide will be effective, I think what matters is that they tried. And so society should recognize effort, not just outcome. But if we want to look at the sheer number of people an individual saved during the Holocaust, a truly outstanding hero is Raoul Wallenberg. Wallenberg was born in Stockholm in 1912 to an extremely prominent Swedish family of diplomats, bankers, academics, and industrialists. He received part of his education here in the United States, earning a degree in architecture from the University of Michigan in 1935. And while there, he also studied English, German, and French. But when he returned to Sweden, he learned that his American degree didn't actually qualify him to work as an architect. So instead, for the next year, He worked in Holland Bank's branch office in Haifa, where he first met Jews who had fled Nazi Germany. Their stories moved him and motivated him to want to help. Wallenberg then returned to Sweden, where he became business partners with a Hungarian Jew, Koloman Lauer, and an import-export company called the Central European Trading Company. Wallenberg leveraged his linguistic skills, and unlike his Jewish business partner, his ability to travel freely around Europe, to visit and learn about Germany and Nazi-occupied France. In June 1944, the Swedish government appointed then 31-year-old Wallenberg as a diplomat in Budapest, Hungary. In that capacity, he launched an operation to rescue Jews by issuing them protective Swedish passports and renting buildings in which to shelter them. The safe houses were disguised as libraries, research institutes, and other supposedly innocent buildings. As an example of his persuasive abilities and his boldness, Wallenberg convinced the Hungarian Foreign Ministry to approve 4,500 protective passports, but then he actually issued three times that figure. The last thing Wallenberg ever said to one of his colleagues on January 10th, 1945 was, quote, "To me, there's no other choice. I could never return to Stockholm without the knowledge that I'd done everything in my human power to save as many Jews as possible," end quote. 7 days later, Wallenberg disappeared forever. Russia claims that Wallenberg died in a Soviet prison in 1947, but witnesses report that he was still alive much later. Details of his fate remain a mystery. The New York Times reports that it is generally accepted that the Soviets executed Wallenberg, but we don't know much more than that. In 1981, Wallenberg was named an honorary citizen of the United States. The only person who had previously received such a recognition was Winston Churchill. Wallenberg was subsequently named an honorary citizen of Canada, Israel, and Australia, and many more honors have been bestowed upon him, including designation by Yad Vashem as one of the righteous among the nations. Some stress the importance of Wallenberg's unique opportunity to help, saying that he was the right person in the right place at the right time. He was a skilled linguist. He was protected by his diplomatic status. He was familiar with Europe because of his business travels. He was an extremely talented actor. And he was bold, often using bribery and blackmail. All told, Wallenberg, with help, is credited with saving the lives of tens of thousands of Jews during the Holocaust. Some estimates of the number of Jews he saved are as high as 100,000. He is honored in the Guinness Book of World Records as having rescued the greatest number of people from death.
You know, you mentioned several of the items for which he's lauded, and I would go back to his naming as one of the righteous people to say, above all, it was his adherence to a basic moral code of life, of people having the right to live.
I completely agree, Mary. Absolutely.
And it's very sad that that moral code didn't extend to his life at the end. There is a recent article in the New York Times about the Holocaust, also in remembrance of International Holocaust Day, and I would urge people to go and find it. And it points out that you can be a hero depending on what is at your hands to do. So we have a person who is skilled in languages and a diplomat, and he was able to do much, and he did. He did the most that he could do. Also the Angel of Budapest. But it calls upon all of us to realize that at a personal level, we can do much. And I call upon everybody in these times to do that. We have barely touched the surface here. Holocaust is not something one can visit in 1 hour. These are wonderful stories of people who kept a place in their hearts and minds for basic morals. Yes, there are complexities in the stories, and it has to lead us to question where we make our compromises and where we draw the line. It's a difficult topic, but in closing, I'd like for Hank to tell us a little bit about his work as a docent for nearly two decades now with the Houston Holocaust Museum. And if nothing else, I urge all our listeners to consider visiting the museum on Monday, January 27th, which is International Holocaust Remembrance Day. Hank.
Thank you, Mary. You know, I actually talked about it a little bit. I don't want to bore our listeners with that a whole lot more. I have a short story, though, that I do want to share with them that was told, that is still being told by one of our survivors. You know, when I first started to work there, there were over 500 survivors. I knew so many of them. Now there are less than 180. And that speaks for itself. The Holocaust Museum serves as a voice for those who will no longer have them. We have to be their voices. It's really a place for making choices. It's about understanding that collaboration and choices is all about us. You know, the notion of why did the Allies not bomb the railroad tracks going in and out of Auschwitz? Well, because they weren't told to. You know, if you are told a joke, it's a racist joke, and you're told, well, you don't laugh, don't laugh. You have to be told not to laugh, right? I mean, we know that it's best not to laugh. If it's not funny, don't laugh. And even if it is, don't laugh. These are choices that we make, if that makes any sense. And that's really what the museum tries to promote. You know, I tell students, for example, at the beginning of a tour, they all have their little name tags. And I say, you know, Billy, if I was your boss and I told you to push Johnny down the steps because it's the only way to get his job and you did it, well, that would be an aggravated assault. What would you tell the cop if the cop says, how come you pushed him down the stairs? And, you know, 8 out of 10 middle schoolers will say, because my boss told me to. And when I ask them whose fault it is, well, they think about it. They say, well, maybe it's the boss's. No, it's your fault. All adults aren't smart. You know, the Nuremberg atrocities, the criminals in the Nuremberg trial said the atrocities were based on war, that they were told to do it. Well, they didn't have to do it. The people who drove the rail cars to the death camps didn't have to do it. There are a lot of things we don't have to do. There are a lot of things that we can stand and do, and the museum points to those people. These two fine gentlemen talked about several of them, King Christian X and Raoul Wallenberg, and there were so many others like LBJ with Operation Texas in 1938, where he smuggled over 500 Jews through Galveston Island when he was told not to. But still, he knew it was the right thing to do. There are all sorts of things that we have to think about in terms of human rights. And I think it's important to understand that it's about choices and about collaboration. I have a short story if we have time for it, Mary. Do we have about 2 minutes?
We do.
Okay. This is by Helen Cullen. She's one of our survivors. And she says, this is one of her short stories called Papa's Demise. When we lived in the Ludge Ghetto, Papa spent the days on the streets begging and pleading, trying to find food for us. He'd been head of our Jewish community in Tucson, a leader who helped people, and now he was reduced to begging. He became a skeleton because he refused to eat so his family would have food. There wasn't much food, but Papa did his best to provide what he could for us. One day, Papa didn't return home. We knew that he would never obey the curfew, knowing that his family would fear that he'd be picked up. Next morning, when his curfew was lifted, Stepha, her older sister, and I told Mama that we were going to find some food. In reality, we went to the morgue, a hut outside the Jewish cemetery. We knew that that was the first place to search for Papa. We stared at bodies of men, women, and children stacked like cords of wood, waiting to be burned. Some had eyes open, staring into space. My sister told me to go to one direction, and I went the other. We looked up and down the rows of bodies, trying to find our loving, gentle Papa. We hoped we were wrong, but Papa had found a safe place and eventually returned home. We didn't want to find him in this madness of stacked human beings. Papa had one toe that was crossed on top of the other. Before the war, we used to giggle and tease him about that. But then I found that unique foot among the corpses. I knew I found Papa. His eyes and mouth were open, as if to say, if I could only survive one more day. And I found Papa. He's over here. I cried to Steffa. I could barely get the words out, choking on my own tears. We stood next to his body, holding each other in disbelief. We removed Papa from beneath a pile of the dead, moving body after body from one stack to the other. We went slowly and gently because there were other people and we wanted to show respect to them. It took many hours before we finally held our Papa. We carried him through the open gate in the brick walls of the cemetery. He was heavy, but we were determined to give our father the righteous burial in a Jewish cemetery that he deserved. I just looked at him, mouth open, eyes open, knowing that he saw heaven somehow. At least I hope so.
Hank, you're a hard act to follow.
Well, I'll tell you one thing, and I do want listeners just to change the tone for a second. We have great programs every week, week in and week out since 2008. Sometimes they're happy, sometimes they're sad. They always make a point because human narratives stretch the boundary of the human heart, and that's exactly what you're paying for when you do donate to KPFT and particularly to this program. We want everybody to keep that in mind for next week. Thank you, Mary.
Please keep that in mind, and I hope that this show has reached you in the ways that I wanted it to touch you, to realize the sadness, the grief, the loss, the humiliation of humankind, the confusion that comes with something like the Holocaust to people who have lived in a country and find themselves to be persecuted. I also wanted you to understand how the goodness of people can rise above the evils at these times. And think within yourself and always think about making the world a better place, even if it's just a small thing that you do. Don't you dare move, because Lars is ready in the wings with Tennyson's Tape Deck. Make 90.1 a part of every day, and while you're driving home, turning in for the night, or just chilling, join us every Thursday at 8 p.m. for So What's Your Story? And treasure what you hear. I do want to thank my two guests, Alfonso and Zach, for contributing their stories. Hank, for contributing some special stories. So keep loving those great stories, and we'll keep bringing them to you. This is Mary Edgerton, and along with the rest of the So What's Your Story team, we never want you to forget that it's never too late to live happily ever after. Peace.